Welcome to this week's Third Opinion Podcast. This week, we'll tell you about how the founder of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, almost had Uganda as the home of the Jewish state. Sounds crazy, but it's true. And we'll also tell you about the threat that the Muslim Brotherhood is to all of us. That and so much more. And don't forget, you can get your third opinion wherever you download your podcast. And now, this week's Third Opinion Podcast. Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Third Opinion on WKDW in the podcast. Two Jews, Three Opinions. I am Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
And I hope you had a meaningful Rosh Hashanah, Lorene, and that everybody did. I made it. I told you last week I went to the Bucks game, which was at 4:30.
Right.
I made it home by 8, took the world's quickest shower, changed into a suit and tie like Superman being Clark Kent, and made it to services before they started.
You know, I got to tell you,
I had to catch my breath, but I still made it on time and got a good parking space, which is, you know, just a miracle.
You know, it was a really, by the way, it was a beautiful service. Scott and I actually, that 8:30 service, Scott and I watched, you know, we had it on the TV because, you know, they you know, you have the option now
of watching
live or watch it. And so, you know, we had just finished our dinner with the family and then, you know, we wanted to watch service, and it was actually a really beautiful service. It was so nice to get everyone back, and the choir this year and the music was just so spectacular. And I just
we belong, for those of you in Tampa, we both belong to Shir Zedek in Tampa, which I guess is the largest congregation here, and the choir it gave me goosebumps. It makes the service to me so meaningful.
It was really beautiful. It was really beautiful.
Okay. One other thing, and then I'll get off this. You know, I'm crazed about the Isaac and Abraham story. So you have convinced me that Abraham took Isaac when Isaac was older.
Right.
And I still don't understand how this 90-year-old man or 100-year-old man could bind him to the wood for the burnt offering. And the story disturbs me. I shake my head every time I hear that every Rosh Hashanah. I just wanted to get that out there.
Isaac also had to willingly lay himself down. And what was interesting, even as Abraham was walking with his son, and, you know, and Isaac was asking his dad, you know, where's the sacrifice? And Abraham said, the Lord will provide. You know, Hashem, he will provide. And God did.
He will provide. Yes.
And God did. Like he knew, he had enough confidence in Hashem and his relationship. You know, I mean, he had to have so much confidence in God all those years, right? When no one else.
Right. I understand.
And, you know, and he just, you know, God will provide. And he just was like, all right, when God's going to provide. And they, and.
In our synagogue, as you know, Lorene, there is a beautiful stained glass window depicting that. And I look at it and I shake my head. Anyhow, I have to say that.
You know what? It's interesting because, you know, even as a little, my grandmother, she didn't have a lot of artwork in her house, paintings, but she had one large painting over her fireplace in her living room. And it was the binding of Isaac. And it was, you know, the angel coming and grabbing Abraham's hand and showing him the ram in the thicket. And
I know.
I guess it
well bothers
me. I've seen, you know, and I don't know. I guess just, you know, I he had confidence. He had that trust. And
I understand.
I like this.
It makes me crazy. But anyhow, listen, we also have to be thankful for those of you who live in Tampa. We are all so lucky because we were in the target of that storm.
I mean, right. We thought we were going to get Tuesday night. As I was telling you, my husband and I, we were obviously watching, tracking Noah so closely, you know, and then we saw when the cool front came in, it shifted south
and our hearts have to go out to those people in the state. It is going to be horrible for them for years to come. Let me tell you one quick story.
That surge. I mean, just watching the surge come in, and we saw, you know, I mean, when the winds,
that could have been us. That could have been us.
And you know, the winds were so powerful, for those of you who don't know, and I know WKDW broadcasts all throughout the Fort Myers area, and many listeners probably, you know, have homes there. The winds were so powerful, it literally sucked all the water out of Tampa Bay. Like instead of
Right.
storm surge, we had the reverse effect. It literally sucked the water out of our bay. And then, the winds, so pushing that surge inland, the way that it was coming around, it was just so
It
devastating.
was yeah, it was scary. I spent 4 weeks in Homestead after Hurricane Andrew, and it was ungodly hot then. Thank goodness that it's cooled off, which makes it easier because these people don't have air conditioning. But the devastation will go on for years. Let me tell you a quick story. I also did a story on the 10th anniversary of Andrew. I went down to Homestead and I talked to the city manager, who at the time was the police chief of Homestead. And he told me the story how the folks from South Carolina who endured Hugo came to Homestead and told these people what to expect. And they said it will fully take you 10 years to
Wow.
recover from the effects of the storm. And the city manager, again, who had been the police chief, said they thanked them, they left, and then they laughed at them. And they said, "That's South Carolina. This is South Florida. It's not going to take us 10 years." And then he paused and said, "They were right, we were wrong." It took them fully 10 years.
I remember I lived through Hurricane Andrew. I mean, it was big, but
Were
you know
you in
what?
South Florida during Hurricane Andrew?
I was. And by the way, we probably should bring in ISRA Aid at some point because, ISRA Aid, which is the NGO out of Israel, which, they're first responders. They're on the scenes in almost every global crisis, and they don't just go for a few days. I mean, they stay long term. I have no doubt, that they're on the ground right now, South Florida,
And
assisting
a lot of,
with the
excuse
recovery.
me, a lot of Jewish groups from Florida, the Tampa Jewish Federation, we're taping on Sunday, is down there right now
Right.
trying to help out today, bringing some food and whatever they can. It's going to be horrendous. And we are so lucky here in the Tampa Bay area, we dodged a bullet.
God bless. God bless.
So now you wanted to talk a lot, and we should, about Russia and the Jews in Russia, because we are both concerned about that, as the war is going badly for Putin, thank goodness. But it's not going well for Jews in Russia either.
It's not, it's really interesting. I mean, look, we all know the history of Russia, the USSR, Stalin, millions of Jews, as well as tens of millions of people died under the hands of Stalin communism. But Jews especially, because under communism, whether it's fascism, communism, socialism, whatever, religion is sort of an enemy of the state. And Jews did not fare well. And, under Putin in the last decade, we sort of saw, he had this relationship with the Jewish community, and I think the Jews sort of had this false sense of security. But since the war with Ukraine began, and I think the concept of Zelensky being a Jewish leader of Ukraine, we have seen the Jewish community come under increasingly difficult times in Russia, a substantial rise in anti-Semitism there. And we mentioned this before, the Jewish Agency, which originally established by Natan Sharansky, the famous Russian Jew who served in the gu who was, he was in the Gulag in the prisons for years. The Jewish Agency, is under direct assault by Putin's government right now. Is no longer allowed to share personal information regarding Russian Jews with officials in Israel, and that's normally how they help get these Jews cleared for Aliyah, to move them safely into Israel. The government is brought a lawsuit against the Jewish Agency for quote unquote violating privacy laws. That trial was supposed to begin in Rosh Hashanah, but they at least moved it to later this month. But and it's estimated that there's around 150,000 active Jews still living in Russia. So this is really a frightening situation of what's happening on the ground. But then what made it worse, Mike, is Putin, about a week ago, was calling for mandatory conscription and told all men of fighting age they were no longer allowed to leave the nation, they had to stay. And he specifically decided on Rosh Hashanah to give a special speech to the Jews living in Russia, letting them know he expected them to make a hefty contribution. And so this is what he said in his speech to the Jewish community specifically. This is Vladimir Putin. He said, "The Rosh Hashanah holiday turns believers to high moral guidelines, which lie at the foundation of all global religions, humanity, piety, mercy, inspires them to do good deeds. It is very important that while retaining their loyalty to old spiritual traditions, that Russia's Jews make a hefty contribution to the preservation of cultural diversity in our country, to strengthening inter-ethnic concord and principles of mutual respect and religious tolerance." So it's, he's, you know, that was his Rosh Hashanah sort of quote unquote warning to the Jewish community. And I thought what was most frightening is that on Rosh Hashanah, there is a spiritual city in Ukraine. It was the home of the rabbi who founded the Hasidic community in Ukraine. So Jews on Rosh Hashanah were in the city of Umam in Ukraine, which is a traditional site for Jews.
It's Rabbi Breslov who is head of a big Chabad.
Chabad, yeah, the yeah. So it's the Hasidic movement that he founded there, and he lived from 1772 to 1810. And so it's tradition for Ukrainian Jews to go to the city of Umam, where his gravesite is, during the High Holy Days. And they came under direct attack of Russian military drones that were provided to Russia from Iran. That city came under direct attack on Rosh Hashanah. And it is very well known to Russia that that city is a city that the Jews go to specifically on the High Holy Days.
It is a dangerous time to be Jewish in Russia. Even Jews who have Israeli passports were not able to get out. They couldn't get into Latvia, Estonia. Which is a lovely country. I don't know if you've ever been to Estonia. It's very cool. But they couldn't get out of the border even with Israeli passports.
Right. And it was really, well, you know, and there's some question of anti-Semitism there, right? Because as long as they had another passport other than Russia, the border guards were supposed to let them in.
Right.
And many of them not only had their Israeli passports, but they also had flights, tickets to go to Israel, to fly to Tel Aviv. Which are right now are just, you know, the cost of those are just astronomical, and they're being denied entry. And so they can't get out of Russia. So and then, you know, obviously we've seen this uptick of open anti-Semitism.
Well,
Russia.
How about the guy in with the swastika killing people at a school in Russia?
I know.
Was it 14 people or something like that?
It's just horrific. I think, you know, I'm very concerned. I think we all need to be very concerned about what's happening right now, because, you know, under Putin, we, you know, look, USSR, Stalin, the Soviet bloc traditionally had been very anti-Jew, but very anti-religion, very anti-God. And religion was forbidden, right? This is why Jews came under attack, especially, you know, religious Jews in particular, because they continue to pray to Hashem. And I'm very concerned about this and how Israel is going to be able to get the remaining Jews out. And this is a very sensitive issue for Israel, right? Because Russia is in very close ties with Iran.
Yeah, and Syria.
They're in Syria on the northern border, operating freely there.
But Zelensky this week was critical of Israel, saying he was disappointed that Israel was not more supportive.
I don't know. You know, honestly, I respect Zelensky tremendously, but I think he needs to back off there. I mean, Israel is in a very difficult situation, and just as he has a responsibility to defend and protect his own people, well, Israel also has a responsibility to defend and protect their own people, and they're under direct threat of Russia and Iran as well on all their borders. In addition, not only that, but Israel was very quick to come out and reject Russia's unilateral, you know, claim to land in Ukraine.
Claimed he took this week.
Yeah, Israel was very fast to reject that. And I think even this week, Israel, you know, welcomed more Ukrainian soldiers into Israel to receive medical treatment. And Israel, the national hospital of Israel, has operating hospitals in Ukraine and war zones to treat people. So I understand.
No, I know, but I feel like on the other hand, his wife, Olena Zelensky, who has just dropped dead gorgeous, beautiful, struck out against our old friend Roger Wood, the anti-Semite from Pink Floyd.
He's an idiot.
But he's backing Russia, and she and his concerts are getting canceled. Pink Floyd's concerts are getting canceled, and she told him to back off and back down.
I mean, you know, he's such a crazy racist bigot, and you know, he's so gross. I mean, I just don't understand the Pink Floyd fans. I mean, you know,
I mean, I love their music. I did. You know, Dark Side of the Moon is one of my favorite albums, but I haven't played that in a long time and probably won't because I'm so irritated with him. And he speaks at concerts against Jews. Now he's speaking out at concerts. You know, why pay money to hear him say that? But anyway, so she struck out against him. I was thrilled to see that happen this week. I thought that was really good. You know, it occurs to me there have been a lot of college incidents around Rosh Hashanah too. College students are under attack because of some far, far, far left-leaning faculty members that just hate Israel and college campuses across the country.
And not just the faculty, but also the students. I mean, I think the most inflammatory incident this week. I mean, I'm just so, I can't stand University of California, Berkeley. I can't stand these school systems and their board of trustees and their professors that they hire and tenure and allow this the student government stuff that they allow happen. So let me just tell you. So we now, University of California, Berkeley Law School now has Jew-free zones. So the university, so as the new semester kicked off, multiple student organizations and University of California, Berkeley School of Law started their school year by barring Zionism, the apartheid state of Israel, and the occupation of Palestine. You know, and what they did is they passed and adopted a bylaw that was initiated by multiple student organizations, but the actual bylaw was initiated by the Students for Justice in Palestine, which is just a farce at the law school, claiming that excluding pro-Israel speakers is fundamental to the, quote, safety and welfare of Palestinian students on campus. And multiple law student organizations, again, these are law students who are supposed to be sworn to uphold the law, the rights, and protect people. The twisted mentality of these human beings, they have no business being given a bar license, be given the right to practice law when they graduate. I think they should be earmarked and not given a bar license, quite frankly. And so they have voted to say that we will not allow anyone who supports Zionism or pro-Israel policies to come and speak to our students, to our student organizations. We will not support any other organization that supports Zionist or pro-Israel speakers to come in. And this is, I can't even think of anything like so disgusting, like these quote unquote Jew-free zones. I mean, this is blatantly anti-Semitic. I was really happy to see Ken Marcus, who is the founder and chairman of Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law, who we've had on the show before. He's sort of involved in this. I think they're probably going to be representing some of the student organizations there. But if I were a Jewish student there, I would be very scared for my safety and concern and about discrimination. But this is just as blatant discrimination. And I'm going to say it again. The California Bar Association needs to challenge these law students of SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, and others who signed on to this bylaw and say, you hold discriminatory racist views. And quite frankly, you can't uphold the Constitution. You can't uphold the laws, and you shouldn't be given a bar license. I really mean that. This is just disgusting, blatant racism and anti-Semitism. I am so angry.
And for those of you who don't
I'm
know,
Maureen
is a member of the Florida Bar. I just want to. She's an attorney.
But you're right. But the fact that, you know, and that the university's not doing anything about it. The university is doing nothing about it.
Like, no, I mean, the university turns a blind eye. Hey, listen, we have got a ton of things about other colleges, but you brought up Zionism, and that is a perfect lead in to Eretz Uganda. What is he talking about? You're saying Eretz Uganda. Believe it or not, Theodore Herzl, who is the founder of Zionism, at one point, I didn't know this, Loring did, at one point considered having Uganda as the home for the Jews. That just blows me away. I thought it was a fascinating story. Thought you might enjoy it as well. Let's take a listen to how Uganda almost became the home to the Jews.
Theodor Herzl was born into a wealthy and assimilated Jewish family in 1860. Soon he came to believe, fervently, obsessively, that only a full-scale Jewish exodus from Europe could bring peace to the Jews. Where would they go? Their own self-governing state, of course, easy or not. Gathering the entire Jewish diaspora in one place would be a challenge. Without Twitter, iPhones, or Clubhouse. Okay, Clubhouse isn't really a thing anymore. How do you get people to move across the world? Plus, the Jewish community was ideologically divided. There's not one Jewish community. There are Jewish communities. Could one movement unite assimilationists, revolutionaries, socialists, and rabbis under one banner? Would Asian and African Jews unite with their European brothers? But there were bigger obstacles than just two Jews, three opinions. I mean, check this out. In the late 19th century, the entire world was still largely divided into empires and their colonies. Austro-Hungarian, Ottoman, Russian, English. What were the chances of a tiny, mostly hated, yes, hated, religious minority carving out an autonomous state from a huge empire? Spoiler alert, not good. If there's anything empires hate, it's giving away territory to folks who want to govern themselves. But like me playing NBA Jam on Sega Genesis in 1995, Herzl was on fire. And he wasn't going to let minor problems like systemic Jew hatred or imperial dominance get in his way. He'd build a home for the Jewish people no matter what. Palestine, Argentina, the Congo, he'd lead the Jews anywhere, as long as they were safe and self-governing. When he shopped around his idea, Jew after Jew insisted, the land of Israel, which was then called Palestine, or bust. Palestine was the Jews' ancestral homeland, the object of two millennia of Jewish prayer. The memory of Jewish self-determination lingered in the landscape. Herzl was convinced. He wouldn't just build a Jewish homeland, but a Jewish homeland in Palestine. This conviction assured his place among earlier visionaries who called for a return to the ancestral homeland. And you gotta know these names. Ready? Here it comes. Leon Pinsker, Rabbi Dr. Yehuda Aryeh Leon Bibas, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, Rabbi Judah Alkali. But Herzl was the first to turn their dreams into an internationally influential movement. Less than a year after he laid out his vision in his book, Der Judenstaat, translated as either the Jewish state or the Jew state, he was trying to convince the Ottoman Sultan to hand some of his territory to the Jews. But everything changed in 1903. The Kishinev pogrom shook the Jewish world to its foundation. How could any Jew feel safe in Europe where a neighbor could smile at you one moment and bury an axe in your skull the next? Where authorities watched and did nothing. Europe was a graveyard, and Herzl was determined to get his people out. So he did something crazy, something that nearly ripped apart his movement. At the Sixth Zionist Congress in 1903, he went ahead and officially asked, "What if? What if we made a little stop in East Africa?" See, Herzl had been wheeling and dealing with some of Europe's most influential players, including the British Empire. The Brits had offered Herzl a slice of their territory in East Africa. They called it Uganda. Today we know it as Western Kenya. So Herzl asked the Congress, "What if? What if the Jews used this territory as a temporary safe haven as they waited to enter Palestine? It wouldn't be permanent, but just as Moses had wandered with the Israelites for 40 years, Herzl would take whatever detours were necessary to get the Jews to the promised land." Yup, he compared himself to Moses. He admitted to the Congress that, quote, Uganda does not possess historical, poetic, religious, and Zionist value, but I do not doubt the Congress will welcome the new offer with warmest gratitude. Well, he should have doubted it, because much of the Congress did not take the proposal well. The socialists chewed him out. The Russians, the people most exhausted by violent anti-Semitism, declared a hunger strike. Some religious Zionists scoffed. Yet Herzl found allies in really unlikely corners. The religious Zionist Mizrahi Party, led by Rabbi Yitzhak Yaakov Reines, backed the proposal. Rabbi Reines believed that physical safety was paramount. That's how bad the situation was in Europe. The security of East Africa trumped, even if temporarily, the ancient Jewish dream of Zion. So when the Congress voted on whether to send an exploratory expedition to Uganda, 295 delegates voted yes. But the 178 diehard idealists who voted no way weren't going down without a fight. When the results came in, the Russian delegation walked out of the hall. A particularly dramatic delegate went through the motions of Shiva, the Jewish mourning ritual. Herzl was called a traitor. The Marxist revolutionary Leon Trotsky, yep, Leon Trotsky was apparently there because history is totally crazy, declared the end of the Zionist movement. Herzl pleaded with the naysayers, promised them he'd do everything in his power to get them to Palestine. And in his final speech to the Congress, he swore, invoking the Bible, if I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand cease to function. But the damage was done. Well after the Congress, the two camps would sneer at each other in the streets, even going so far as to wish death upon one another. Before the proposal could tear the whole movement apart, the three scouts returned from East Africa with their report. And the sole Jewish scout amongst them, Nachum Wilbush, had grim news. East Africa was totally unsuitable for habitation. Ironically, the territory boasts some of the continent's most fertile farmland. There's a strong possibility that Wilbush had an agenda. The Seventh Zionist Congress took Wilbush at his word. In 1905, they voted to kill the Uganda plan. Herzl didn't live to see the Seventh Zionist Congress or the founding of the state. Still, he was confident in his place in Jewish history. Despite his iconic beard, which I'm totally jealous of because I really can't grow one, Herzl wasn't religious. But I don't think I'm too far off in calling him a prophet. In 1897, he wrote, "At the first Zionist Congress in Basel, I founded the Jewish state. If I said this out loud today, I would be greeted by universal laughter. In 5 years, perhaps, and certainly in 50 years, everyone will perceive it." He was right. 50 years later, in 1947, the United Nations agreed to a partition plan. Soon after, Ben-Gurion declared independence. We can look back at the short-lived Uganda proposal as both a teasing glimpse into an alternate reality and as another layer in the Zionist story. Because for Herzl, Zionism was partially about safety. He cared deeply about the physical security of Jewish bodies, but Zionism isn't just about safety, and it isn't just about self-determination either. Those are components, yes, it's true. But as the Russian delegation proved, Zionism is inextricable from Israel, and Israel is inextricable from the Jewish people. A Jewish liberation movement cannot be untangled from the Jewish homeland. Jewish history is embedded in every inch of the land. The Zionist movement reconnects us with that history, with that land, with the other exiles who prayed towards Jerusalem for 2,000 years. Herzl dared to ask, what if? What if there could be a safe haven for the Jewish people? What if it was in Uganda or Argentina or Palestine? That's the most compelling scenario of all. What if an indigenous people came back home?
What a wild story that is, Lori.
It is a wild story. And I knew about it. Like, I knew that the proposal had been made, that it had, the offer had been given. And Baruch Hashem, thank God they didn't do it. You know, like, Uganda's not, it's not Yerushalayim. I mean, why do we pray about Yerushalayim every day? Every Yom Tov, every holiday, every day is like praying, we pray towards Yerushalayim. I mean, like, the whole thing. So, so crazy. And not to mention, by that point,
I just thought it was a fascinating story. You know, a couple other college things we ought to get to.
Wait, I had to say what was interesting about Uganda. Like, at that point in time, when it was being proposed to Herzl and the land was being offered him, I mean, there are more Jews living in Jerusalem, because you got to remember, it was like a desert wasteland. There was more Jews right. living in Jerusalem than there were Arabs or any other racial group. There were more Jews living there at that point in time. So the whole thing was so absurd. So thank God we didn't do that. But yeah, definitely a lot more going on college campuses.
Yeah, okay. At Rutgers University, it was the AE Pie House was egged on Rosh Hashanah. I was an AE Pie at the University of Missouri, a very Jewish fraternity. It was egged during Rosh Hashanah. At the University of Michigan, there was an incident on Rosh Hashanah. They threw anti-Semitic, papers.
I mean, this is a big deal. And by the way, this is not the first time Rutgers, the AE Pie, has been attacked. They were attacked on Yom HaShoah, where they were doing 24 hours of reading names of victims of members of the Holocaust, and other times were by members of the Students for Justice of Palestine, you know, again, which is just like an oxymoron of a name, because they don't actually care about the Palestinian people. They just care about hating Jews. And I just wonder, like, everybody, like all these politicians, you know, and the governor comes out and condemns him, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, great. I'm sure there's videotape. Like, what are y'all doing to arrest these
prosecute kids, these people? Dude, right.
What are you doing to arrest them and prosecute them? Why aren't these kids being prosecuted? I don't understand. Like, I'm baffled why we can keep reading about these incidents, but we never get to report on prosecutions. It's the same story we had last week where Richie Torres, God bless him, the congressman from New York, was pretty much calling out the governor and all in New York saying, why are you not prosecuting anti-Semitic hate crimes? Like, over 100 violent anti-Semitic hate crimes, and there's only one record of prosecution.
One prosecution in New York, right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So,
it's bad.
In this country.
We have got to take a break. We've got a frightening interview that Lorene did with an author, Cindy Farhood. It's part two, and she talks about the Muslim Brotherhood. And let me tell you, this is frightening. We need to pay attention to it. But let's take a break first. We'll come back to that. This is The Third Opinion. That interview in just a moment. But have you looked at our webpage, where you can listen to previous editions of The Third Opinion podcast, find out more about our hosts, and leave a comment or two? And now, back to The Third Opinion podcast and that interview. Welcome back to The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
And we're on WKDW and the podcast. Lorene, tell us about Cindy and her book. And this woman knows more about the Muslim Brotherhood than probably anybody around.
That's right. So her book is The Secret Apparatus, The Muslim Brotherhood's Industry of Death by Cynthia Farahat. That's Farahat. She is an Egyptian American. She was born and raised in Egypt. While she was there, she co-founded the Liberal Egyptian Party. And she now works for a think tank in D.C. where she focuses on Middle East, in particular, specifically the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, and exposing really their long-term goals of global jihad and terrorism, and how it sort of crosses the lines between both Sunni and Shia. They don't care whether you're Sunni or Shia. The whole point is to bring about a radical Islamic jihad. And I think what she's talking about and what she's exposing, and her book is all very well documented and annotated. She, you know, tells you there's not a statement in there that is not annotated, that pretty much every word is coming from the mouth.
Yeah, very well researched. Yeah.
Right. Very well researched. And these are that her book is really, it's all information that comes directly from the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think it's a very chilling awakening to the reality of this sort of secret war we're in with Muslim Brotherhood, and we need to be more aware of it. So,
and she's right. And she starts out by talking that actually there are two Muslim Brotherhoods. Let's take a listen.
I see it as there are two Muslim Brotherhood regimes in the world right now. So these two countries are Turkey and Qatar. Turkey and Qatar are card-carrying members of the Muslim Brotherhood. The leadership, the top of the leadership, and everyone else in the regime works there is a member of the group. So that's where the brains for the terrorism operation is. That's why it drives me crazy when someone from America or from Israel tells me, oh, we're going to ally with Erdogan because he's going to protect us against Iran. Erdogan was on the second flight that landed in Iran in 1979 to greet Ayatollah al-Khomeini. He was on that flight. You're not going to hear this anywhere else.
Wow.
According to my analysis, so it's a fact that he's a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. But according to my analysis, he is the head of the secret apparatus of the Muslim Brotherhood.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. Obviously, there isn't a lot of coverage on it, but we do know that Erdogan obviously has been changing Turkish society over the last 10 years, has become a dictator. But beyond that, he put out the 20-year plan about the global jihad to return and restore sort of the Muslim world. And that document, which got some news coverage, didn't get a lot. Can you comment on that?
So Erdogan is consistently working on reviving the Ottoman Empire. And in 2016, the Muslim Brotherhood lead theologian Yusuf al-Qaradawi announced him a sultan of the, and they started using the term Ottoman instead of Turkish. They view him, they're trying to revive the Ottoman Empire, and they view him as the caliph. That's according to their words, that's literally, they call him the caliph Erdogan. So he is a narcissist. He is extremely fanatic. He's been like that since he was a teenager. He has been very successful in turning his country into, and I prove this in my book, that his country is command and control center for smuggling jihadists across the globe. And actually, I found evidence for that. So Erdogan is a huge, huge threat that I do not think has been taken seriously by countries in the West, nor by the Israeli government.
Yeah, and it's frustrating, right? I mean, he's a member of, Turkey's a member of NATO, which really limits our, in some ways, the government's ability here at the U.S. But, I want to shift because I know, we only have so much time, and I encourage people to get your book and read it because this is so informative. But one of the things that frustrates me is this propaganda that the Muslim Brotherhood is really a political entity, it's a peaceful entity, and there seems to be this desire to make a distinction between their military wing and their political wing in the European countries of like, well, we don't want to call Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist entity because not all of it is terrorist related. And that's really part of their propaganda agenda, down to the fact that they are behind Students for Justice in Palestine at university campuses in America, right? Muslim Brotherhood has their tentacles far and wide as far as shifting the mindset of the next generation. So can you talk a little bit about their propaganda agenda, their deceptions, and how they've been so successful in this propaganda, which I think is the most frustrating thing for many of us that are at least aware of what they're doing?
I have what you just said as these talking points. I was offered millions to say that in bribes, millions of dollars in bribes in powerful positions in the U.S. and outside of the U.S. to say these talking points, by the way. So I would urge your listeners, when they hear this, to think someone is either very naive or ignorant or is they have sold their voice. So I don't see any other way around it, because the facts and evidence is that I'm going into all its details in my book proves that they are the command and control center of Islamic terrorism across the globe. Their own bylaws say that it's prohibited for any Muslim Brotherhood operative in any country to operate on any level independent of the laws of their leadership, which they call the Guidance Bureau.
Right. And so, Cynthia, let me just stop you right there, because I just want to make sure the listeners were clear. What I said verbatim, Cynthia is saying, is that there are members of our government and people that have been bribed to not say publicly what I said. And even Cynthia came under tremendous pressure not to author this book. I think it's really important that there are that they're operatives, that they're even entwined. And I know your book talks about this, that they're even entwined in key positions in the government here in the United States. And I think that's really important for people to understand. You mentioned that, but I want to make sure that's very clear, because I know your book talks about this. And we need to wake up. We need to be informed and not necessarily listen to what the talking heads in some of these government agencies or in DC are telling us. I apologize, Cynthia, for interrupting you. I just want to make sure that was very clear to our listeners.
Yes, you're absolutely right, because you said, oh, they're telling us that they are different chapters, that they're not related. You were spot on. That's their exact propaganda. And your second question, how they were successful, is because what you also said earlier, it's because they are employing the Nazi propaganda tactics still today in their messaging. That's why they're successful. They're still employing the Nazi and Soviet tactics of propaganda.
It's really amazing. You know, and even to the point that they are impacting the way people perceive them on college campuses. You know, obviously when the Egyptian leader, you know, the member of the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, was teaching at a campus in California, for instance, you know, it's interesting how they are entwined with the university system. Can you comment a little bit on that? Because I don't think our listeners fully understand, even to that level, their influence with our children on college campuses.
Oh, it's much worse. It's much worse than anyone can possibly imagine. When you read my book, you will see something horrific. There is a gentleman called Ahmed Abdel Basit Mohammed. This is a convicted terrorist in Egypt and a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, self-proclaimed member of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Egyptian government sentenced him to death because of his involvement in the 2015, 2016 assassination of Egypt's top prosecutor, Hisham Barakat. He was also associated with numerous terrorist attacks in Egypt. On his own Facebook page, he said that he was involved in organizing one of the worst terrorist attacks in Egyptian history, where 506 people were killed and maimed. This gentleman said that the mass shooter at his event was seeking God while he was spraying bullets. That man is a professor at Union College in New Jersey.
Wow.
Yeah.
Enough said. I mean, and you have to ask yourself, like, how is it that this man was allowed into our country? And then beyond that, knowing his background, was allowed to then be a professor at a university and is teaching our children. I mean, most of these kids are going to that classroom having no idea what this man's background is. Certainly the parents are completely in the dark. And that's just one of multiple examples. And I know that all your information that you share in your book, Cynthia, as you and I've talked, comes directly from Muslim Brotherhood. You're using their own words.
Yes, I even have screenshots of his admissions. It's overwhelming. I had someone fact check all this information. This is because it's so shocking and disturbing to think that a mass murderer, terrorist, jihadist is teaching your children at Union College. And I contacted Union College, and they haven't gotten. They said, oh well, We received your message, thank you, and they ignored me afterwards. So they know. They've known for a very long time what's happening over there. But that's okay for them. So that's why we need to ask ourselves, what are these colleges doing? What are they doing? What are think tanks doing? I had a piece published yesterday at the Federalist talking about Qatari foreign funding and how it influences think tanks. So they are everywhere.
Right. I mean, when you think about how, like, for instance, Ismail Haniyeh, when he, you know, the head of Hamas, you know, he was living a very cushy life in Qatar. You know, he was over in Qatar, you know, and Qatar was just hosting him. And while his people, you know, in Gaza are suffering and he's living the high life off of, you know, the billions of dollars that are flowing into Gaza. These things people assume they don't want to talk about. You know, Mike and I, we've been focusing on San Francisco State University, for instance. That's been, you know, there's a professor there that leads the Middle East department, right? And he's been trying to bring in a terrorist from PFLP forever, ultimately ended up hosting it in Lebanon. And so this is a university that is sort of promoting a terrorist, you know, as sort of a freedom fighter for these college students. So I think these examples are really key and important to understand that the larger patient propaganda agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood. And for our readers. And so I encourage everyone to sort of get this book, get informed, understand it. You know, I know we need to wrap up shortly. So I just wanted to end on a question, really sort of where do we go from here? I mean, with the U.S. government, you know, where do we go from here with them? How do we, you know, what is the U.S. government doing today? And what should they be doing differently when it comes to the Muslim Brotherhood?
First of all, they have to designate them as a terrorist organization and stop working with them. The reason they haven't designated them yet is because the State Department and some intelligence agencies are working with the U.S. with the Muslim Brotherhood. So they need to stop doing that because it has never worked. And every time some government tried to work with them, they ended up infiltrating it and eroding it like a cancer from the inside out. So that has to stop. And designating them as a terrorist organization would stop people like Ahmed Abdel Basit Mohammed, for example, from teaching your children at Union College. It will stop a gentleman called Mohammed Elibieri from becoming a DHS senior advisor when he was under President Barack Obama. It will stop a lot of these people who are affiliated with terrorists from lobbying Congress. It will stop Osama bin Laden's webmaster, Mazen Mukhtar, from lobbying U.S. Congress. So there is a lot of things that it could benefit. We have to start there. And this has to be an election issue. Whether you're left, right, center, this has to be a critical issue. The designation of the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization.
You know, Laureen, one of the things that I thought was significant that she said is that Erdogan of Turkey, who was going to visit Israel, is no friend of the Jews.
I agree with that. I mean, you can't trust him. When he is considered by the sort of Muslim Brotherhood, you know, society as sort of really as the one to usher in the next great caliphate, you know, in the return of the Ottoman Empire. And, you know, when he's been open about this plan, I mean, he had a 20-year plan. That's why he's so active in Northern Africa and Algeria and Libya and different things. I mean, he is, there is concern, and she raised grave concern. She's very concerned about Israel sort of reopening those ties with Turkey and with understanding that. And so, you know, I appreciate what she's saying. I think, you know,
I am glad he's going to Israel. You can at least open discussion.
I mean, yeah. I mean, at the same time, I mean, is it really going to? I don't know.
You know what really upset me this week, though, is that there was a survey in Israel. Only 36% of Israeli voters are in favor of a two-state solution. To me, that's the only way to peace.
Well, I think, again, so let's make some clarification. Some I think it's really important here. They're not looking for a one-state solution and the alternative. What they're saying is that at this point in time, it's just not possible because you don't have a partner for peace. And without a partner for peace, you know, to legitimize a state that is a state of terror on your borders it doesn't make any sense. And how would that work? And, you know, what are the restrictions? Are they allowed to arm up and then continue to attack Israel? Like, I think there's a lot of real concerns there when you don't have a real partner for peace.
I understand, but we've got to work toward a two-state solution if we're ever going to have any.
Look, everybody wants to work towards it, but you can't when you don't have a real partner for peace. I mean, who are you going to negotiate with? I mean, Abbas, who's like applauding terrorists and who keeps terrorists on the payroll, who's a, you know, great, keep killing.
And give, yeah, I know. And they give money to terrorists. And, I don't. He struck out at Blinken this week, our Secretary of State.
I know. Unbelievable.
What did he call him? It was really.
It was like something like a child or
a young child or something like that. Yeah.
But I thought, it's really. Abbas is really concerning. Then you see, I guess Arafat's nephew is now back in Gaza. Like, I don't know if he wants to take control again. I mean, God help us. Arafat, let's just be clear. Arafat was a thief. He was a thief. Not only was he a murderer, but he was a thief. He never wanted, even though he's the Camp David, he never wanted peace with Israel. He had no intention of ever agreeing to it, which is why when Israel offered him everything he wanted, he rejected it. He stole billions of dollars from the Palestinian people. He and his wife were living the high life in Paris. She has so much money, it's ridiculous. All that money belonged to the Palestinian people, but did it go to them? No, because corruption reigns and it's all in his pockets, just like Ishmael Haniyeh and the other leaders of Hamas don't even live in Gaza. They're living the high life
in Paris and
everywhere else. You know, it's ridiculous. It's just absolutely ridiculous.
You know, one other thing we ought to mention before we run out of time, the protests going on in Iran.
Oh, yes.
That was because of the death of an Iranian woman who the morality police arrested because they said she wasn't dressed correctly.
Her hijab wasn't on enough.
That's right. And now Iranian women are protesting in the streets of Iran. It's pretty amazing to
me. Right. So her name was Mahsa Amini, a beautiful young woman who literally was like beaten to death and tortured by the morality police of Iran, you know, because they didn't like the way she had her hijab on. And people are just, I mean, there's a massive nationwide protest against the Supreme Leader. Just people saw the photos of her face all bloody, her in the hospital on oxygen, like right before she died. I mean, the people of Iran are just outraged, you know, as they've continuously been. And of course, it's estimated that over 76 people have been murdered by the Iranian regime who have gone out to protest, over 200 people arrested, including multiple journalists who will probably be tortured and God only knows what will happen to them. By the way, in the wake of that, I'm a little perturbed by this story that came out. So the Iranian television is proclaiming that the U.S. is getting ready to unfreeze $7 billion of Iranian money after releasing two American detainees. One was an 85-year-old man who was suffering from horrific health conditions who worked for UNESCO, and then his son who was 50 because they were accused by Iran of being spies. But they're claiming that the U.S. has agreed to unfreeze $7 billion.
I don't like that either. But we are running out of time. Laureen, have a easy fast, and everybody else, as Yom Kippur is coming up this week. And we all wish a sweet and happy new year for everybody. And we got to get out of here. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Laureen Jaffe.
Bye.
You all be sealed in the Book of Life.
That's our show for this week. Hope you'll join us again next week. And don't forget, subscribe to the Third Opinion Podcast wherever you get your podcast. And thanks for listening.